So let's cultivate our motivation. So imagine that any time you saw any sentient being, doesn't matter who, your feeling, your instant feeling, was one of connection with that person. Not alienation, not being excluded or left out. But what would it be like to anybody you meet, human, non-human, all the bugs? Yeah, and the deer and the turkeys, the squirrels. Yeah, anytime you saw any sentient being, your feeling was one of really connecting with that living being, wanting them to be happy. So what prevents us from feeling that whenever we meet anybody? Are we distracted by our list of things to do? Do we just have a generally apathetic attitude towards others? Are we suspicious of others? And what about Atisha, who, whenever he saw any sentient being, said, "Hello, Mother," recognizing them all as having been his kind parents in previous lives? What would it be like to look at sentient beings like that? So let yourself look at sentient beings that way. Think of all of them in that light. And generate an attitude of affection, compassion towards them, closeness. And from that, generate bodhicitta. And make that intention to attain awakening for the benefit of all beings your motivation for not only listening to this teaching, but for your whole life. So when we look at it, you know, why is it that we don't feel that when we see others? It's the afflictions are being active, aren't they? And particularly the self-centered thought. You know, when I see others, there's the opportunity, like Atisha, you know, he sees somebody, and instantly his mind would go to, that's somebody who's been kind to me. That's someone I can trust, unless something else happens later on. But even then, I'll be able to forgive that person. Yeah. So it's actually, you know, the self-centered thought that prevents us from seeing others like that, because often we're so involved with ourselves that when we see others, we can't even see that they're a sentient being like us who wants to be happy and not suffer. We just see them as something out there in the environment to steer our way around. Or maybe, you know, our first, because of habit, our first reaction is, I better be careful, this person might help or harm me. But do you see how it's our mind that is setting up this whole way of interacting with others? It's not coming from them. It's coming from us. Yeah. And it's coming from thought. Yeah. She might say, oh, but something happened in the past to prove to me that there was danger, or that this person had it out for me, or whatever it is. Yes, there may have been that, but there's also from the past the fact that they've been our parents and have been kind to us. Okay, so why do we believe one and not the other? It's usually a matter of habit. Yeah, maybe the harm came in this life. Yeah, whereas the kindness was in previous lives, so we don't notice it as much. And then just out of our habitual ways of thinking, we only pay attention to this life instead of, you know, the big picture. Yeah. But I keep thinking of Atisha, you know, carrying his stupa around, you know, because he carried a stupa wherever he went. So if he broke one of his precepts, he would immediately pull out the stupa and make prostrations and confess. But, you know, he'd see a donkey and he'd say, hello, mother. Yeah? So try that. Yeah? Try when you see some living being. Yeah. If hello mother doesn't work for you, you know, try hello sweetheart or whatever you want. Yeah. And see that how you're relating to that person is created by our own mind and dependent on our self-centered thought. And it's not a hard and fast rule or situation that is realistic. Yeah. And so just practice that. See if you can remember to make that a habit as you go through your life. Yeah. And it really changes. Yeah. I mean, I do that especially with bugs. There's so many bugs in my cabin. Yeah? And so, yes, I want to take them out and place them outside. But, you know, they're worthwhile sentient beings. Yeah? And this morning, I inadvertently killed one, you know. And so I said, take a good rebirth. And as much as possible, I'll try and help you in your next rebirth in the Dharma, you know, so that we make some kind of positive link with living beings. Mm-hmm. Instead of, well, that's just some spider. Sangha Rinpoche, when we took him to the beach in Los Angeles, he always had his mala. He was an exceptional lama. You know, he fell asleep in the dentist chair. But when we took him to the beach, there were all these sea anemones. Those are the ones that kind of have a mouth at the top. Yeah, that closes. So, you know, he wanted to, well, I figured out what he was doing. It took me a while, but he would go from one sea anemone to the next and put his mala in its mouth until it started to close and then go on to the next one. And I realized what he was doing was he was making a karmic connection with these living beings so that in future lives, when they had the capacity to, and interest to understand the Dharma, there would be a karmic connection and he could teach them. Yeah. But the other people on the beach were looking at him like, what's this guy doing? You know. Okay. So we're going to continue with chapter two. And I don't know, maybe I'll just use the book today instead of the outline. You can refer to the outline yourself. But, you know, we're in the middle of the section. First, we saw the benefits of generating bodhicitta, and now we're trying to prepare to take the bodhisattva vow, and before that, generate the aspiring bodhicitta. And in order to do that, we have to purify our mind. And so we are in the section now about the purification practice. So regretting our non-virtue, taking refuge and generating, you know, bodhicitta towards others, doing some remedial action, such as making offerings or bowing or offering service, and then making a resolve not to do the action again. So we started this whole four opponent powers couple of weeks ago, I think, maybe even 3 weeks ago. But there's a lot to it. So I think we are in the section right now. We're on verse 42, but we'll start with the verse before. 41, okay. Okay, so then we'll start with 40. So 40 says in chapter 2, while I am lying in bed, although surrounded by my friends and relatives, the feeling of life being severed will be experienced by me alone. Okay, so here we are at the end of our life. Yeah. Friends, relatives, everybody's around us. They're all involved in their own feelings about us dying. Yeah. They seem to be paying attention to us, but actually they're involved in their own feelings of grief or guilt or worry or planning for the future or whatever, okay? And at the end of our life, we've done a lot of actions in relationship to the friends and family and created a lot of negativity. Lying for their benefit, being miserly to benefit the family, cheating on taxes, not paying fees so that the family has more money, spraying insect, you know, killer Raid all over the place so the kids don't have to see any ants. You know, for family and friends, we've created a lot of negativity. But at the time of death, all those people stay here, and the objects that we were relating to either make our family and friends happy, you know, or make somebody else who was harming them suffer, all those objects, all those people, they're staying here. And our mind goes on alone, and the experience of separating from this body and this life and our whole ego identity is experienced by us Yeah, not by the people in the room. They're all involved in their own thing. Yeah, so if they're crying about, you know, because you're dying, they're involved in their feeling of grief. Yeah, we may say, oh, they love me so much, they're crying, you know, and that's how much they love me. But actually, they're involved in their own feeling. You getting what I'm saying? Yeah? Because we can see how we do the same thing. And, you know, a few years ago, I was with an old Dharma student who was dying, and his wife was there, and some friends were there. And while he was actively dying, I was the one, I'm really glad I went. He was in another state, but I'm really glad I went because I was the one telling him what to think and how to think and, you know, doing all of that, because the other people who were much closer to him, you know, in this life, being very close friends or spouses or whatever, they were all absorbed in their own grief. Yeah. Later, after he died, then, you know, we all recited some, you know, different texts together. But while he was actively dying, they couldn't, you know, there was no way they could do that. Yeah. Okay. So the same goes for us when we're dying. Yeah. If you, really check up if you want your family and friends around you. Yeah. Some Dharma friends who knew what to say to you would be helpful. But Dharma friends, I mean, even they sometimes cry. That's going to be difficult. Yeah. I remember one other time I was asked to go visit a home where somebody was dying. And they were, when I got there, they were in the bedroom. The family was in the living room. And the family wanted to talk to me. So I actually spent a long time talking to the family to help them deal with their grief. And only a much shorter time dealing with the person who was actually dying. Yeah? Because the family had so much to process. So when seized by the messengers of death, what benefit will friends and relatives afford? You know, they will be out in the living room talking to whoever is this, you know, trying to guide them spiritually. And you'll be in the bedroom, the one dying who really needs the spiritual guidance. Yeah. My merit alone shall protect me, but upon that I have never relied. So at the time of death, I can see death is approaching. There aren't real messengers of death that are like other sentient beings, but you can tell in your body when you're dying. That's the messenger of death. You know, what good really can people we're attached to do for us? Especially if they don't know anything about the Dharma. Yeah. And so at that time, what really helps us is our merit. But during our life, we never really focused on creating merit because we were too distracted having a good time, celebrating Christmas, you know, doing, you know, watching the presidential convention with balloons dropping and confetti flying and all these people on the stage cheering. And wasn't that exciting? Yeah. So not like this year's convention, which I find actually much better. I never watched the other ones. The other ones, I mean, just people trying to score popularity points. But this one, when there's nobody out there to cheer them, then you really hear what people think. Yeah, a little bit more, hopefully, what they think. Yeah. By the way, last night was all about women. Yeah, there were maybe, I don't know, three men who spoke, maybe four. Yeah, Barack Obama spoke, and amazing, amazing what he said. You've got to listen to that. But everybody else was filming. And I, wow, a political party that knows we exist, you know, that cares about us. Wow. So it was quite nice. Yeah. They said lots of good things. Okay, verse 42. O protectors, I, so unconcerned, unaware of such terror as this, accumulated a great deal of negative karma for the sake of this transient life. So unaware of death, just going along like, death's not going to happen to me. Or if it does, it won't be for a long time, and it definitely won't be today or anytime soon. And so not even thinking about what happens at death, not even preparing our mind to die, yeah? And some people not even preparing their worldly affairs to die. Yeah, that really denying death. You know, I'm not going to make a will, I'm not doing an advanced directive. I'm not doing a power of attorney. Yeah. So, and then you're dying, and what are you faced with? I'm losing everything. Yeah. Not only the material things that I collected. Yeah. So your whole scrapbook, all the family pictures, all the little mementos from things that you experienced in your life, all of that you're leaving behind. And anyway, you can't, you know, what good is it going to do you when you die? Okay? You want to put all of that around your room? Yeah? You're dying. And, oh, there's the picture of me on my first date at 14. And I mean, come on. What's that going to do? Okay, and so, you know, when he talks about terror, it's a sense of terror of like, there's a feeling like everything I am is dissolving and I'm separating from it. And there's terror because who am I going to be? Will I even be something or am I going to become non-existent? Yeah. And so that feeling comes up, or regret comes up for how we treated other people when we were alive. Yeah. And so we realize how much negative karma we've accumulated for the sake of this transient life where we can't take anybody or anything with us. Yeah. And when you think, especially, you know, the people, you know, because we all are attached to our reputation, yeah? And what people think of us and wanting to be known. And all of that totally evaporates. Yeah. Okay. Maybe they write an obituary. Yeah. But you think I'm going to like some obituary you write for me? I'm going to edit it. Okay, this is what I do with everything. You know that. So, but I won't have a chance to edit it. I'm going to be dead. Okay. Yeah, yeah, you can write, but then you won't be able to include all the wonderful things I've done. Okay. So, you know, there's that. And then, you know, people, I'm sure somebody, you know, after 100 years will probably do their PhD thesis on Shravasti Abbey. You know, I mean, a lot of people already are doing their MAs. They interview us. They interview Western nuns, you know, even, you know, papers they have to do for undergraduate work. Certainly somebody's going to come along and do their PhD. They'll talk about all of us, You know, maybe they'll have a copy of our team plan, you know, who did what and this and that. And they'll look on the website. There are the baby pictures of all these nuns and match them to what job they had at the Abbey, and they write their term paper, their dissertation about it. They get their degree. They do a little bit of analysis, you know, which is probably totally off because they never knew us and they didn't know how we thought, how we think. And we're not going to be around to, to say anything about it. Like, you know, what you wrote in your dissertation about me is wrong. I'm not like that. Yeah. Or maybe they, you know, really made the stuff in their dissertation glamorous. I mean, wonderful. These nuns were so, they were pioneers and leaders. Yeah, and so what? You know, we're in our next rebirth doing what? You know, are we even human beings? Yeah, or are we some frog outside of Ananda? Yeah. So, you know, to really think about that, you know, what are we doing and why? And what is important and why? And what is not important? Okay? Because if you do this when you're alive and you focus your life on what's important, then when you die, there's no regret. Yeah? And there's no fear because you haven't created a ton of negativity, you know, and your mind is prepared. So that's why they say for the good practitioners, it's like going on a picnic when they die. Yeah. 43, petrified is the person today being led to a torture chamber with a dry mouth and dreadful sunken eyes. His entire appearance is transfigured. What need to mention the tremendous despair when stricken with the disease of great panic, being clasped by the physical forms of the frightful messengers of death? Okay, so if somebody's very scared, you know, maybe you were traveling in some country. You were in Afghanistan on some trying to help an NGO and you got kidnapped instead. Yeah. I mean, it would be terrifying. So that's verse 43. You know, you're terrifying of what, with fear of what's going to happen. And so, but that kind of terror is nothing than the terror at the time of death when we're really leaving everything behind. Yeah, I mean, if you're kidnapped by the Taliban, maybe the American embassy will help. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, or your own state embassy. I'm sure the German embassy would do a good job and get you out of there. How would we feel? And yet at death, we're really separating from more than that. Okay? So here's what's going on our mind in verse 45. Who can afford me real protection from this great horror? From feeling like I am going out of existence or feeling tremendous regret at the way we've treated other people. Or tremendous regret over things that we should have done and we didn't do. Yeah. That was actually, it was a fear of regret that got me to quit my job and go to Kapan, because I had met the Dharma in California. And then after that, I had a sense that, if I didn't learn more about this, I was going to suffer a lot of regret. And I always had the sense that my dad had some regret about his life, even while he was alive. And so I never wanted to, you know, I always had this idea, I don't want to die with any regret. And so even though, you know, my family was like anything but happy, I quit my job and I went to Nepal, because I felt like if I don't do this, I'm going to regret it when I die. Okay. So who can afford me real protection from this great horror? With terrified, bulging eyes agape, I shall search in every direction for refuge. Okay, so our mind full of panic. Okay. Looking for some safety somewhere. But because we have not created safety in our own mind, when we're looking for safety when we die, we don't even know what safety looks like. Yeah. Upon seeing no refuge anywhere, I shall become enveloped in gloom. If there should be no protection there, then what shall I be able to do? So, you know, I'm dying. I'm separating from everything. I can't control where I'm going to get reborn. What do I do? There's nobody else around to help. And my friends and relatives can't do anything. Yeah. So seeing this possible scenario at the time of death, then we say, therefore, I now seek refuge in the Buddhas who protect the world, who strive to shelter all that lives and with great strength eradicate all fear. So seeing the possibility of this kind of panic and fear at the time of death, now, while I'm alive, I seek refuge in the Buddha. Okay? Well, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, of course. So what does it mean to seek refuge? Do we just go, Buddha, I'm scared? Yeah, and then, you know, Buddha kind of manifests in front of you, rushes in front of you, and, you know, kind of like Mickey Mouse with a cape. Yeah. Mighty Mouse. So it's not like Mighty, you know, remember Mighty Mouse with his cape? Yeah. Or Popeye. Popeye coming. You remember Popeye? Some you young ones, do you know Popeye? Oh, good. Okay, you ate spinach. Yeah. So, you know, is that what we think is going to happen when we take refuge in the Buddha? Yeah, that they're going to appear before us? No, that's not what happens. Okay. What happens is we remember the teachings that they gave us. Yeah. And if we remember the teachings well, there might be an appearance of a holy being in front of us. But that appearance is a manifestation of our confidence and our complete devotion to the path and wish to actualize the path. Okay, and the way the Buddha really teaches us and helps us and protects us is by giving us the teachings, you know. So can you imagine when you're dying if, you know, here's where a virtuous friend would help. They would, you know, give you some teaching to think about or tell you to remember your teacher or tell you to think of the qualities of the three jewels, or tell you to think of bodhicitta, or remind you to think of emptiness. Yeah, good friends would do that at the time we're dying. Yeah, but it's by remembering those teachings that is what really will help us at the time of death. But, you know, as Shantideva is saying here, I now seek refuge, not when I die, then I'll take refuge. Okay, we have to take refuge now. We have to develop that connection with the three jewels now in order to be able to remember it at the time we die, because we're very much creatures of habit. Yeah, and, you know, we will remember what we're most familiar with. So if we want to think of the three jewels and the teachings at the time of death, we have to develop that habit now. Okay. And that's why doing that visualization before we take refuge and generating bodhicitta at the beginning of the teachings, that's why that's so important. Because then you're really cultivating that relationship, you know, every day in a habitual way. And then chance is that then you can remember it at the time of death. Okay? So the Buddhas who protect the world protect it by giving teachings. The Buddhas who strive to shelter all that lives. Yeah? So to know that the Buddhas have love and compassion for us. So when we're sitting there feeling alienated, unloved, rejected, underappreciated, to realize that the Buddhas are sheltering us with their compassion, that we're not all alone out there in a bleak universe. Okay. And the Buddhas who with great strength eradicate all fear. Yeah, what eradicates fear the best? The meditation on emptiness. Okay. Next best, meditations on bodhicitta or on impermanence. Okay. Then 48. So here, now we're seeing what could happen at death. So right now, in this life, we're turning for refuge. So 48 says, likewise, I purely seek refuge in the Dharma, which they, the Buddhas, have realized. Clears away the fears of cyclic existence. And also, I take refuge in the assembly of bodhisattvas. Okay, so the Dharma is the real refuge. It's the true cessations and true paths. Okay, that the Buddha and the Sangha have actualized in their own mind streams. But what makes the Dharma the real refuge is when we actualize true cessations and true paths in our own mind stream. Yeah, because then our own mind stream protects us. I, trembling with fear, offer myself to Samantabhadra. To Manjugosha also, I make a gift of my body. Okay, so when I'm making a connection with the Buddha Dharma Sangha, I realize the danger that I'm in if I don't practice. So that when it says fear, it doesn't mean panicked, scared out of your wits fear. It means we're aware of the danger. Okay, and we want to be cautious facing the danger of a death without having practiced. Okay, so we offer ourselves to Samantabhadra, to Manjushri. Okay, and he says, I make a gift of my body. So, you know, you read this a lot in different prayers, you know. When we do the inner offering, the whole visualization is to imagine our own body becoming Mount Meru and the four continents and you know, the old ancient Indian vision of the structure of the universe. We imagine that, but do we really feel like, okay, I'm giving my body away. It doesn't belong to me. Yeah, because the more we can really cultivate that feeling, yeah, it doesn't belong to me. It belongs to the holy beings. Therefore, I have to use my body, speech, and mind in a way that accords with, you know, what the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha value and think is worthwhile. Yeah, I can't give my body to the three jewels and then use my body to harm other some sentient being, because the three, you know, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas cherish other sentient beings more than they cherish themselves. So if my body belongs to the holy beings, they're certainly not going to use it to harm sentient beings. So therefore, I can't use my body to harm sentient beings. And I shouldn't use my speech to harm other sentient beings either. Yeah, or even my mind. Yeah. So thinking like that really helps us. You know, when we say, if you're doing the sixth section Guru Yoga, you know, that I give my life to the, you know, to the Buddha, then you really feel, you know, you are giving your life, and it's not for me to go, you know, oh, I feel like doing this, and, you know, and all our petty kinds of thoughts, because we've given that to the three jewels, and they certainly are not going to use, you know, our life energy to think stupid things. Okay, so I find it very, very helpful to help stop negative actions and to really enforce and to really create virtuous ones, and again to create that feeling of closeness to the three jewels, because I've given my body, I've given my life to them. Yeah, so Dharma is really the center of focus of my life. And it's not just about my own enjoyment, my own happiness. So these kinds of meditations, you know, when we do them a lot, it really helps to create that kind of feeling. To the protector Avalokiteshvara, who infallibly acts with compassion, I utter a mournful cry. Please protect this miscreant. Okay, so I mean, poor Kuan Yin, Avalokiteshvara, so popular, so many countries, always people are crying out, Kuan Yin, Chenrezig, Avalokiteshvara, help me. Don't help that one. I'm first in line. Help me. I'm suffering more than this other person. Don't help them. Help me. You know, can you imagine what these bodhisattvas listen to when sentient beings make prayers to them? Yeah, think about it. Think about it. Think about what sentient beings pray for. Yeah. There's somebody in New Jersey, please, Avalokiteshvara, I want a new car. Yeah. And somebody else in some section of New York that's Catholic, please may my daughter marry a nice Catholic boy. Yeah. I mean, these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas listen to what we ask them to do. And we do it in a business style, yeah? My daughter marries a nice Catholic boy, then I'll make an offering. But first, you deliver on what I'm asking you to do, Chenrezig, then I'll make the offering. If you don't deliver, if she doesn't marry a nice Catholic boy, you're not getting an offering. Yeah? That's kind of what it boils down to sometimes. Okay. In my search for refuge, I cry from my heart for Akashagarbha, Kashidigarbha, and all the compassionate protectors. And I seek refuge in Vajrapani, upon the sight of whom all harmful beings, such as the messengers of death, flee in terror in all directions. That's because Vajrapani, there's one peaceful aspect of Vajrapani, but usually he's in a wrathful aspect. So frighten the messengers of death. Okay, but really, you know, this is saying, so now here during this life, I'm going to cry out for help to these bodhisattvas. What are you going to cry out for help for? What are we saying to the bodhisattvas and the Buddhas when we make request of them? Yeah. So this is for us to look at, what am I requesting? What, when I dedicate my merit, how do I dedicate it? Okay. And then recall all the request prayers that we say. Now, three principal aspects of the path. Yeah, Yonten Shingyuma, the foundation of all good qualities. The glance meditation at the end of Lama Chopa. All these request prayers are asking for inspiration so we can generate the different realizations on the path. That is something the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are very happy when we request. Because when we request inspiration to generate those things, then we're actually on the way to making true cessations and true paths our actual refuge. Yeah, because we're really wanting to generate those different virtuous qualities. Okay. So that's why there's so many request prayers that we recite at different times. And it isn't so that, Chenrezig can rush down and go, okay, here's your realization of cherishing sentient beings more than yourself, and here's your realization of emptiness. You know, they aren't something physical they can give, but they can inspire our mind, mm-hmm. You know. And it's a dependent process. Yeah, they inspire, we stay open to the inspiration and we act on it. Okay, 53, previously. So we're here, we've invoked the whole Buddha Dharma Sangha, you know, and we're going to them not with arrogance, like, look what a great practitioner I am. Yeah, I did these, how many treats I did, you know, I gave teachings here, I, you know, gave refuge ceremony there, I did this, I did that, I did 100,000 mandala offerings, doesn't mind, I didn't concentrate on any of them, but I did them. You know, we don't go to the three jewels with, you know, our Dharma CV, yeah, we go with a mind of humility. Yeah, looking at the danger that we could be in and really, you know, seeking their guidance and inspiration. Yeah, and wanting to practice the guidance when they give us instructions. Okay. Previously, and this is what we say to them, previously I transgressed your advice. But now, upon seeing this great danger, I go to you for refuge. By doing so, may this danger be swiftly cleared away. Okay? So by our practice, can we clear away all the danger that we experience? Because things become dangerous to us only when we are vulnerable. What makes us vulnerable? Attachment, self-grasping, yeah, self-centeredness. That those are the things that make us vulnerable. When we're able to overcome those, then the things that were dangerous for us before are no longer dangerous. We don't care about it. You know, we always hear the story of the Buddha when he gave, when as a bodhisattva, he gave his body to the hungry lioness so that, or tigress, so that she could eat it and then feed her kids. Yeah. Do you think the Buddha was afraid of the pain of being eaten by a tiger? Huh? At that time, you know, as a high bodhisattva, there was no worry about pain. And even if they experienced pain, it was like no big deal because the power of the compassion overrided any kind of feeling of pain in the body and mind. Yeah. So when we're not attached to our body, giving it to a tigress is not a problem. Okay. When I'm not attached to this packet of tissues, giving it to somebody is not a problem. But when I'm attached to this packet of tissues, because I'm terrified of having a drippy nose in front of a crowd, and I don't want to share not one single tissue with anybody else. Yeah. Then, because of my attachment, yeah, this package of tissues has power over me, and I'm afraid of losing it. Yeah. So watch what you become attached to. Sometimes the most ridiculous things. Okay. Venerable Sumpton is helping me relinquish my attachment to plastic-covered, paper clips. Yeah. So that's good. Because I always want to give away the mental paper clips. Because they're not as nice. The plastic ones I want to keep for myself. But I don't want to even use them. Because if I use them, then I won't have them. Okay. Anybody else like that? You're attached to something, but you don't use it. Or you don't eat it. Because then you won't have it later on. And the thought of having it actually gives you much better feeling than having consumed it. And yet, even, you know, we're attached to it because we're thinking, I want to consume it. It's going to give me happiness. But actually, that thought gives us more happiness than consuming it. Because if consuming it gave us more happiness, that's what we would do. But we didn't. We don't. We save it. So we don't consume it. But we can't give it away. Even though when we give it away, we're in the very same situation of not consuming it. So we're not losing anything by giving it away. But the thought of giving away is too painful. Yeah? And that's why the king, Nagarjuna in Precious Garland, you know, said to the king, give away all your wealth before you die, because after you, you know, at least then you can use it to create merit and your wealth will be of some use to you and it'll be of some use to sentient beings. Whereas if out of stinginess you can't give it away and you can't even use it, yeah, then how ridiculous can that be? Yeah. So I think I have some karmic connection with that king. You know? For the, you know, I cherish the plastic-covered paper clips. Okay. Empty bottles. I save empty bottles because you never know when you're going to need an empty bottle. And if you give them away, they won't be there when you need them. But don't ask me for an empty bottle, because I'm saving it for when I need it. So there's a whole collection of empty bottles that will never be used, that I cannot bear to give away. Actually, I'm getting better. I recycled a bunch of them a few months ago. Yeah. Because I knew during COVID I wouldn't be traveling, so I would have more time to replace the ones I recycled with new ones. Yes.
Do you think that your life in India, having very little, has influenced these needs to keep things for long periods of time?
I think it did, but also before that, as a kid, I was very thrifty. Yeah, I tend to be very thrifty. Yeah, so that's why, you know, when we have expenses at the Abbey, I mean, I look at that checking report every time it comes and see if all the expenses make sense. Okay, I tend to be quite frugal. And, you know, it's not a bad thing in the sense that it prevents a lot of pollution in the world. Yeah. I mean, who turns the lights off at night here when we have guests who forget to turn the lights off? I usually wind up walking around and turning the lights off. You know, the men's wing, they can't turn the light off in their entryway. So I'm always out there, you know, right before I go to bed, turning the light off there, turning the light off in here if somebody has, you know. So that's my character. That's how I am, so don't ask me to change. So 54, if I need to comply with a doctor's advice when frightened by a common illness, then how much more so when perpetually diseased by the manifold agitations of desire and so forth. So when I go to the doctor, you know, why do I go to the doctor? To get some medicine. So I should follow the doctor's advice. Yeah. And why? Because we're frightened by a common illness. We're frightened by death or by a lot of pain from an illness. So we follow the doctor's advice. Okay. So if that's the case, so how much more so when we are suffering from the disease of attachment and self-centeredness and a store of non-virtuous karma? Yeah, we should really follow the advice of the doctor, you know, the Buddha, the great physician. But then you have people who don't go to the doctor when they need to go to the doctor, or people who go to the doctor, get a prescription, get advice, and don't follow it. Yeah, and there's a lot of those people. And it's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, why to go to the doctor if you don't want to do what the doctor says? So the question also is, why do we go from one lama to another lama asking what we should do with our life if we don't really intend to follow it? Or if we already know what we want to do and we just want somebody to tell us what we've already chosen as the answer? Yeah. So, and when teachers teach, you know, we always think that the advice of the teacher is only the personal advice. When we go and talk to them individually and your teacher says, you know, do purification, then we go, oh yes, I will do purification. Yeah. But in a general teaching, if the teacher says purification is really important, everybody should do it, then you kind of ignore it because he didn't, you know, they didn't really tell me. They told the group. So our mind is thinking that the only real instruction we get is when the teacher tells us individually, and that the rest of the teachings to the group, well, they're nice, but not for me. And that's the wrong way. That's not how we should look at it. Okay? What we hear in the teachings, we should try and practice. Now, granted, we may not be able to practice everything all at once. So we, you know, develop things in sections. We do things gradually with the eye to, you know, do more advanced things later. Because, you know, if we started doing everything we've heard teachings on right now, we might be overpowered and really confused. But we should take the teachings that we hear, especially the Lamrim and Lojung teachings, and really put them into practice as best as we can. We shouldn't depend on a private meeting with our teacher to tell us exactly what to do. Yeah. Otherwise, why did the teachers give public teachings? Yeah? Why don't they meet with every single student individually? Okay, you come in the room, do purification, get out of here. You come in the room, do purification, get out of here. You come in the room, do purification, get out. You know? Yeah? Is that the only way for teachers to get us to do, to follow their instructions? And if all the living people living on this earth can be overcome by just one of these, and if no other medicine to cure them is to be found elsewhere in the universe, then the intention not to act in accordance with the advice of the all-knowing physicians that can uproot every misery is extremely bewildered and worthy of scorn. So if all the people living on the earth can be overcome by just one affliction, you know, and their life become a mess because of one affliction, and that goes for me too. And if there's no other method to cure it because the scientists are too busy with hydrochloroquine, yeah, and they haven't invented a pill to get rid of attachment or self-centeredness yet. Okay, so there's no other medicine to cure it except Dharma practice. Then the intention not to practice the Dharma, not to follow the advice of the all-knowing physician, the Buddha, and that advice is such that it can root every misery and its causes, then that's extremely bewildering why someone wouldn't do that. And even worthy of scorn, you know, like, what are you doing? You're saying you're a Dharma practitioner, but you're not, you know, trying to do anything. Okay. So maybe we'll stop here. And verse 57, and leave some time for Q&A.
When you were leading the motivation, the thought that came to me, and I've thought about this a number of times since seeing these photos of these National Guards who, or whoever they are, in these uniforms where there's no identification, you can't see their face, they all look the same, they're armed to the teeth with all kinds of weapons and tear gas canisters and you name it, those flash things. Mm-hmm. And that kind of person, I can't yet cultivate compassion for. I just feel afraid because they're so unpredictable. And if I was in a crowd of peaceful protesters, I just know that I would be overcome with fear. Mm-hmm. So I'm stuck there with that kind of image of someone who doesn't look like human, that's recognizable because they all look the same. Mm. And yes, they're suffering. They're probably terrified themselves, but so I'm compromised right now.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, I'm not saying be foolish in the face of worldly danger. Yeah. I mean, when there's worldly danger, you want to protect your precious human life. So you want to get out of there. I mean, why hang around when you're going to get clubbed, Okay, that's not serving any purpose at all. Okay. But, you know, if you watch and you watch what your fear is, it's interesting fear to search what am I afraid? Am I afraid that they're going to harm me? Or am I not even getting to that stage? I'm just afraid because of the way they look. I'm not even imagining the harm they're going to do. It's just the sight of them makes me afraid. Yeah, it can be quite interesting to investigate our fear and like what's really going on here, you know? And then if it's like, okay, I'm afraid because they all look alike and they look like a bunch of, Martians out of a Hollywood movie, okay, then stop and say, but they're sentient beings with feelings. Yeah, and they're probably scared too. Yeah. And if they aren't scared, then they're overwhelmed by anger. And so they're afflicted by anger, and they're miserable. Nobody's happy when they're angry. Yeah, so kind of think of how they must feel. And I'm sure they would much rather be at home relaxing than, you know, dressed in fatigues with all that equipment on them facing a bunch of rioters. Yeah. So, you know, don't just like, yeah, because you can kind of see them and make out of them some Hollywood looking creature. And, huh?
Stormtroopers.
Yeah, the stormtroopers. Yeah. Yeah, but you can make out of them some. Anyway. Yeah, let Hollywood do that. And our minds do it, okay? But then remember, that's not what's underneath all that fatigue. You know? Yeah, there's a living being who wants to be happy and not suffer, who's scared or angry and would much rather be somewhere else than there at that very moment.
Someone is asking, if someone has no Dhamma friends, no center nearby, but is a practitioner, how can they be helped to die well?
Practice very well in this life so that you can guide yourself when you die. Or make arrangements with some Dharma friend so that somebody can call them and you can talk to them over the phone while you're dying. But best protection is to practice well now.
So if what the teacher says, if you can practice what the teacher says, even if she doesn't say it to you but in a group, then can you say that someone is your teacher if you only receive teachings online?
You know, that question is coming out a lot now. And, you know, I have a yes and no answer to that. On one hand, His Holiness has said when he gives Jainongs or Wongs, that people can take them online. So if you can take them at the time the teacher's actually giving them, then that teacher would definitely become one of your teachers, okay? And, we give refuge and precepts online now during COVID or even before that when some people are in prison, you know, I do the refuge and precept ceremony online. And so then, you know, that link is made. So I think in some ways you can consider, when you hear teachings, you can consider that person your teacher. On the other hand, you don't have quite the same link as when you're in the room with them hearing teachings directly. I think when you've been in the presence of a teacher and have that relationship then when you hear the teachings online, that same feeling is there. I personally have never had the experience of creating a relationship with a teacher that I have never met in person, only online. That hasn't happened. So I'm not sure really what to say. I think it depends on your mind. You know, you can think of that person as your teacher, but you also may want to check them out more before thinking of them as your teacher, you know, and follow, you know, how His Holiness describes the qualifications of the different levels of spiritual mentors and check that person out first, instead of like you hear a teaching online and it's like, wow, fantastic, that person's my teacher. And then you learn that they're actually somebody who's quite controversial or somebody that nobody even knows about or, you know, something like that. So I think it depends on a lot of different conditions.
Someone is asking, how can I let go of my fear when I experienced in my life in Venezuela with Chavez so much fear by the government and the military on the streets?
Ooh, any chance of getting out of Venezuela? You know, it's I think your only choice in that situation is you just practice compassion. That's all you can do. You know, you practice compassion towards all those people who are, you know, the military on the street and Chavez in his palace. And you practice compassion for all the people who are, you know, living under that kind of fear and despair.
She clarified that she's now living in Mexico.
Good.
I think maybe that fear, I think from the question that fear is still there from the past experience.
Yeah, compassion, that's the way. Yeah. I mean, that's the only, you know, either focus on emptiness or generate compassion. Yeah. And why compassion? Because compassion takes us completely out of ourselves. We're no longer focused on our own set, our own self. And we're also, when we have compassion, we have to change how we are seeing others. Yeah. So you have to change how you're seeing Chavez and the military, you know, in the streets. You have to see them as ordinary, suffering, sentient beings. Then you can have compassion for them. But when you're seeing ordinary, suffering, sentient beings, you know, then your own fear isn't activated that way. So we take refuge in compassion. There's a video online somewhere, I saw it once, of His Holiness. And you know that prayer in Lama Tripa, you are my guru, you my yidam, you're my, you know, Dakini and Dharma protector, where they're reciting that, you know, and there's a very moving melody in which you recite it in Tibetan. And His Holiness starts to cry during that. And then he explains afterwards, when he's thinking of his guru, he's thinking of bodhicitta. He's thinking of great compassion. Yeah, that's who his spiritual mentor is, his yidam, his dharma protector, and so on. You know, great compassion and bodhicitta. So, okay, so we'll close here.